Hey, welcome everyone. We're very pleased to have Eric Antretz here today. And Eric is a PhD student with Aram Harrow and has also done work in Misha Lukin's group. His work has been primarily in quantum algorithms. Correct me if I'm wrong, Eric. And
That's right.
today will tell us about interpretable quantum advantage in neural sequence learning. Eric, please go ahead.
Thanks, David. Yeah, so thanks for the nice introduction. Again, I'm Eric from Aram Harrow's group at MIT. And today I'll be talking about very recent results of mine done with people over at Harvard and Misha Lukin's group on interpretable quantum advantages in machine learning. So most of these results come from this paper. The first of these listed, I don't know if you can see my cursor. But then also to motivate this, I'll talk about a couple of my other results from this last year on the trainability of quantum machine learning algorithms. So before I get too into the weeds on what I'm talking about, let me just give a brief overview of where I'm going with this. So first, I'll just give an introduction of quantum neural networks in general and variational quantum algorithms, if you've heard of those. And really just say why I've been interested in these recently, and in particular, why I've been recently interested in restricted classes of quantum machine learning algorithms. So I'll get more into what I mean by that later, but coming from there, I'll then introduce my main results and talk about how certain classes of restricted quantum neural networks are powerful. And then finally, I'll move away from theory land a bit and then give some numerics showing how these results practically show up more realistic machine learning scenarios. So let me just get started giving some background on quantum machine learning. So if you've seen quantum algorithms talk in the last 3 years, you've probably seen a version of this slide. But just to introduce it again. We're in this NISQ era of quantum computing where we have these noisy intermediate scale quantum devices. And they're starting to do things that are kind of on the verge of classical intractability. And it's a bit of an open question if there's anything useful that maybe slightly less error-prone versions of these devices, slightly bigger, within the next 10 years, there's anything interesting that these devices can do. And of course, in the far future, when we have large error-corrected quantum computers, there are already a million proposals to do things like factoring or Grover's or HHL or whatever. But of course, NISQ devices today, these noisy near-term quantum devices, even with these error mitigation strategies that exist, are probably too error-prone to implement anywhere close to these kinds of algorithms. So really the goal, and what I've been interested in recently, are finding algorithms that quantum computers can practically do, hopefully in the nearest term, that use simple quantum subroutines to minimize the quantum resources required for doing these kinds of algorithms. So there's a broad class of meta algorithms, I guess you could say, called variational quantum algorithms that a lot of research effort has been pushing in recently. And essentially, all this is saying is, okay, whatever problem you're interested in, let's phrase it as some optimization problem. So let's say we have some function f that we want to minimize, and let's assume for whatever reason it's expensive to evaluate classically. So the canonical example of this is like we have some molecular Hamiltonian, and we're capable of preparing ansatz states on the quantum computer so that we can evaluate some energy under some molecular Hamiltonian efficiently on a quantum computer, but it might be difficult to do this classically. And then what you can do is then just perform some optimization procedure on a classical computer and really just use your quantum computer as a bit of a black box where, you're essentially just evaluating gradients or loss function values or whatever of this loss function on your quantum computer using calls from your classical computer. So just to give a more concrete example of this, so if you are doing something like gradient descent to try and optimize this loss function, you can use a quantum computer to evaluate some gradient somewhere, and then use a classical computer to do a gradient step, and then evaluate another gradient, and then just bounce back and forth. So this original proposal is from 2013, I think, where this group was interested in looking at optimizing molecular Hamiltonians, finding the ground states of these molecular Hamiltonians. And they showed that in certain instances, this works okay. And so it's been a field of ongoing research, what you can do with these variational quantum algorithms, maybe beyond this chemistry setting. And if you hear optimized complicated loss function, a natural next step is to say, okay, that's like machine learning. So can you phrase some kind of machine learning problems in this way? And the answer is yes. And there's been lots of research in this direction recently. So this particular figure is from an Eddie Farhi and Hartmut Nevin paper over at Google, where they looked at using essentially very generic parameterized quantum circuits to perform classification tasks. And the question is, okay, we can go through all this trouble of implementing these variational quantum algorithms or these quantum machine learning architectures, but is there any point? Are they powerful? You know, is there any reason we should use these over traditional machine learning architectures? And perhaps unsurprisingly, if you believe, you know, quantum computing is powerful, you can show that the answer is yes. So probably the easiest example to explain is this recent result linking the power of quantum machine learning algorithms to the discrete log problem. And essentially what you can show is that you can take a linear classification problem and then sort of mask it by making a data set where if you take the discrete log of this data set, you get some linear classification problem. And then classically, the data will look kind of random and be hard to classify. But quantumly, you can just take a discrete log and then it's a linear classification problem and it's easy. But of course, with doing this, your quantum model essentially has to be like error corrected, right? Because you have to do difficult discrete logs or whatever. And the side effect of this is you're implementing very generic quantum operations on your quantum computer. And if you want to have any hope of training these quantum operations, like it's not obvious that intuition from classical machine learning, that machine learning models are trainable, carry over to this quantum case where you're exploring like exponentially large Hilbert space. So actually, there's been a lot of results recently, including some of mine, that show that generically, when you're doing this training, it actually won't work. So this table is from a paper of mine from fairly recently. Actually, today I found out it got accepted to NatComs, so hopefully it'll be out soon there. And essentially, the paper showed that if you have local, shallow quantum machine learning models, they're actually generally not very trainable because you have really bad local minima in your loss landscapes, which is completely counterintuitive if you come from classical machine learning, where essentially large neural networks are always trainable. It's not the case in quantum machine learning. And just to explain some other rows of this table, these first three rows are some other results that say that deep quantum machine learning models are untrainable because they have these really exponentially vanishing gradients. So they're difficult to estimate via sampling, just from the shot noise. This reference four is another one of my papers from ICLR that looked at non-local quantum machine learning algorithms and also showed that those were hard to train. So if you take everything together, it essentially says that generically, these are difficult to train. And it's due to, in essence, how generic the models are. So if you have a deep quantum model, and it looks pretty generic, like you're in a generic point in parameter space, essentially due to scrambling of quantum information via how generic this model looks, when you're trying to measure gradient observables, the signal is going to be like exponentially small, and it's going to be impossible to measure it in any reasonable amount of time. And then in my results, there's somewhat similar intuition for what happens for shallow quantum models, where essentially you get some local scrambling behavior, and you can use this to show you have really poor local minima, even if your gradients aren't exponentially vanishing. So this plot also comes from that same paper that that table came from, and it's a loss landscape for a quantum convolutional neural network. And if you're trying to maximize this, it's just practically impossible because you'll get stuck in a local maximum somewhere along while trying to optimize. So taking it all together, you know, this is not great news, but really the key point is that there's this laconic generally here. So this is what is true in the general case. And this motivates looking at restricted classes of quantum machine learning models, or just generally more restricted classes of variational quantum algorithms, and hopefully showing that some restricted classes are able to balance trainability and expressive power. So the ability to do things more efficiently than classical models may be able to. So that's really the motivating thrust behind my research recently and this result that I'm now going to talk about. I don't know if there are any questions so far. If not, I'll take silence as no questions. So classically, people look at linear models often in classical machine learning to think about trainability or expressivity or whatever. And what we did in this paper was do the same thing quantumly. We quantized linear classical models, and we just saw what came out. We saw how powerful they were. And as I'll explain later, as a bonus to this, it allowed us to gain intuition as to what realistic problems these kinds of quantum models might be useful for. So I'm going to get into it now. So the kinds of problems we looked at were translation problems. So given some input sequence of XI, you can think of these as like words in Spanish or sentences in Spanish. Output some translation Y. So we have some input words X1 through XK, and we want to output some translation Y1 through YK. Really formally what this is we're trying to sample from a conditional distribution that's these Y given these X's. And classically, there are a million models that do this, you know, like Google Translate is a thing. So a lot of research has been put into this. And there are things like RNNs, LSTMs, GRUs, transformers, all of these models you may or may not have heard of that do this pretty well. And what we're going to consider here are linear versions of these models. So just to explain what's going on in this diagram, this is a very generic picture of what an RNN looks like, a recurrent neural network. And what it does is at each time step, it takes in an input word, and then it has some trainable function fi, but then outputs some translated word, and then also some latent representation that kind of acts as a memory for the model. So if you have an adjective or whatever, modifying a noun at the end of a sentence, it's able to keep some representation of it in memory. And we're going to consider models that are linear, where these fi are linear functions, and quantize them and compare them to generic classes of classical models. So what happens when you quantize this? You get what we call a contextual RNN. And essentially what it is a bit more powerful than a Gaussian model, if you're familiar with CV quantum mechanics. So just to explain more clearly, this unitary U takes the place of this function fi that's trained in the classical case. And what it is it's quadratic in quadrature operators on this space of lambda and on operators on the space of phi, this phi register. So in other words, it's some Gaussian operation. And just for simplicity, let's assume that the original hidden state is some Gaussian state. And then to make this not just simulatable with figure function simulation, we're going to consider input states, these phi e, which kind of take the place of these x's in this figure. We're going to consider non-Gaussian versions of these states. So in other words, maybe for concreteness, you can think of what this is these phi e can be qubit states, for instance, and this u can be some displacement operator on these CV modes here given by lambda that might be controlled on these phi e. So you can have like a quadratic interaction governing this, but this phi e is a qubit state. And importantly, what you can do in this setup is you can do phase estimation on this lambda register by controlling on this phi register, essentially. And what you can do is you can measure contextual observables on this lambda register. So I'll explain what I mean by that in a second, but generally what this is capable of doing is, for instance, measuring the CV version of poly operators on this register using by controlling on this qubit register. So what do I mean by contextual observables? It's probably easiest to just give an example. So if we just consider qubit poly operators and arrange them in a table like so, this is called a Merman-Perez magic square. You can arrange them in such a way that the products of the rows give identity operators, and of the columns give plus or minus identity operators. And this is just some, you know, comes from the Pauli algebra. But because of these relations, it's easy to see that if you try and assign classical values for these observables, you get some inconsistency with the fact that these products must equal plus ones and minus one. So in other words, when you're measuring quantum observables, it's not like you're revealing some classical information that's stored in the quantum observable. You know, there's some quantum contextuality effect going on. So just to give yet another example, if I'm measuring these three operators on this final row, and I get plus one and plus one, these all commute, so you can measure them in whatever order you like. But that constrains this final measurement to be plus one just by this Pauli algebra. But if I had those same measurement results, but I was instead measuring these operators, z, z, and xx, then this final measurement is constrained to be minus one. So in other words, you need to, if you're trying to simulate this process, you need to remember not only what measurement results you previously output, but also what measurements were performed. So measurements are contextual, quantum mechanically. And this example is with qubits, but there's a similar example for CV poly operators or displacement operators. So this motivates a translation task you can do that's just, okay, given classical description of these displacement operators, output measurement results consistent with what you would get if you were doing it quantum mechanically. And of course, the CRNN by construction can do this because it's built to do measurements of displacement operators. And the intuition is a classical model trying to do this procedure has to memorize what previous measurements were performed to get the correct outputs for later measurements. So early words in whatever sentence you're translating affect the translation of later words in this translation task. And so with this intuition, what we're able to show is this quadratic memory separation, where there are certain tasks that a CRNN of size n can perform perfectly, but no subquadratically sized classical neural network can do this task. And I'll be more concrete in a little bit. And I should say that you can recover a super polynomial separation predicated on complexity theory assumptions or whatever if you add a little bit more resources that I won't really get into in this talk, but because we're focused on these trainability, in this trainability regime, we're gonna focus on this quadratic separation for now. So yeah, classical neural networks is a very broad term, so let me be more specific. Essentially, we're considering classical models of one of these two forms. So this I showed earlier, this figure B is what a transformer is, if you've heard of that. So these are very popular nowadays in classical machine learning. And really the only assumption is that these Fi, or in this case, this encoder epsilon or E, are locally Lipschitz. So in other words, they're continuously differentiable almost everywhere. And this basically includes any kind of model that people actually use, like RNNs or transformers or whatever. And importantly, this holds even when the classical model is nonlinear, which is somewhat surprising, even though we're just quantizing a linear model and showing the separation. So fairly quickly, the way the proof goes is we look at poly operators that are essentially graph state stabilizers, the CV version of them, on some initial Gaussian state. And then what you can show is that when the latent space of the classical model is of too small dimension, so if you're trying to cram too much information in some sense into too small a latent space, you're gonna have some non-injectivity. And we're actually able to show something stronger. It induces a fiber bundle structure. So effectively what your classical model must be doing is projecting out this fiber of this input space onto some base point on some base manifold. So in other words, it's not able to distinguish between states which are stabilized by these inputs that share a fiber. And then what we show is that there's some like pigeonhole principle kind of argument that when the dimension of these fibers is large enough, they must share contextual stabilizers. And then from there, we're able to show there's this one-shot distinguishing measurement sequence that essentially says, because the classical model can't distinguish between these states, there is some witness of contextuality that will prove it can't distinguish between these states. And essentially it's gonna get a translation wrong for one of these inputs. And again, a nice aspect about this result is that it doesn't rely on complexity theory, and it really directly links this this separation to quantum contextuality. And again, there's an asterisk that it turns out that by adding GKP states in certain other parts of this model, you get a super polynomial separation. But I won't get into that. But just know that we can also bump up to an even larger separation while losing some of the nice properties of this quadratic separation. Okay. And I only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to talk a little bit about numerical simulations of this system, because again, we show a quadratic memory separation in doing this, but we also show in our paper that there exists a quadratic memory overhead algorithm in simulating these systems. So just to see how well this model performed on more realistic tasks, we looked at a standard Spanish to English translation task. We looked at models with 500,000 model parameters. And we saw that with translating these sentences, these are just random selections of Spanish sentences, the models are so small classically that it's essentially never able to get a correct translation. But the majority of the time, the quantum model gets it correct. So to be a bit more quantitative, here's a quantitative plot. So here we fixed a CRNN of a specific size. And that's what this dashed line is. This is the achieved KL divergence on this Spanish to English translation task. And then we varied the size of a transformer. And we wanted to see where the performance of the two models was roughly equivalent. And it was right about where we predicted in our constructed translation task that we use for our proof, which is pretty surprising, actually. So really, this says that, yeah, in practice, it also seems to be that the quantum model is able to take advantage of this contextuality present in it to even have an advantage on more realistic translation tasks. So that was my work on this. And in the future, I'm interested in being able to interpolate a bit better between this regime where I'm able to show a quadratic separation, and then also this regime where essentially you're doing very generic quantum computing and you can get super polynomial separations. So maybe by limiting the magic of your system, are you able to interpolate between these two extremes and show a regime where you have more than a quadratic separation, but maintain trainability of your model? And then this model requires qubit photon interactions, which I imagine are difficult. So relaxations of this that might be more experimentally feasible, and concerns that have to do with, okay, can we, like the resource requirements and error mitigating this, where we're only using Gaussian interactions essentially, or whatever interactions, these spin quadrature interactions. Maybe fewer resources are required to error mitigate these systems. So looking into that. And then finally, looking more specifically at how trainable these CRNNs are. I motivated this talk by constructing this restricted class of models such that it's trainable. And numerically, it is trainable, but it'd be nice to have a nice proof proving this. Okay, so thanks for having me. And are there any questions?
Okay, let's thank Eric for a nice talk. And if you have questions, just please go ahead and raise your hand and we'll go in order. Maybe I can get us started. I think it's really interesting, this quantum recurrent neural network architecture. Have you seen these works by Brierley and others on temporal Bell inequalities? They call them there's a paper called Non-Classicality of Temporal Correlations.
I can look it up.
So I wonder if some of those earlier works can be rephrased in this setting or show some results along the same lines. Because, I mean, the main result of that paper is that if you have a quantum memory of a certain size and you have a task, again, where you have an input coming in and an output, but you pass it along, mm-hmm. it's a very similar task. And I wonder if the techniques are similar or if maybe by looking at that old literature, I think it'd be an interesting contrast or some
comment. Yeah, it would be interesting. I'm skimming it now. I've not seen this.
Well, there's no there's no need to try to process it right at this moment, but it's just a comment, I guess, or a suggestion.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Question from Cece. Go ahead.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for the nice talk. So, my question is, so if I understood it correctly, so you've proven this advantage of this quantum network compared to the classical case using a quantum information processing task, and then you show it would also be useful for like translation and so on. So is there any intuition why this quantum advantage translate to the classical case advantage?
Yeah, so great question. So the quantum advantage is proven in this example that, you know, the contextuality is really this quantum contextuality where there's some memory effectively stored in the fact, like what previous measurements were done on the system. And what we show in the paper when we numerically simulate this is that essentially how you can numerically simulate this is by doing like a Gaussmann-Knill kind of simulation to get this quadratic memory simulation of this process. And there, and when you're doing that as like a machine learning model, essentially what you're storing extra information in is in your matrix of stabilizers, like your check matrix. And this really is what's giving you like a quadratic extra memory that can be passed along in your neural network. So training these models is able to leverage this extra memory in some sense, and in practice gives an advantage as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Thanks.
So maybe I can ask, I don't know, maybe this is similar to what CC asked, but why is contextuality helping translate from Spanish to English? I mean,
yeah. So for quantum tasks, it's more obvious, right? Like there's some memory overhead that's needed for a classical process to memorize what previous measurements were done in this system. Whereas the quantum system just naturally keeps track of that. So what you could imagine is, for instance, I mean, this is not how Spanish works in any sense, but wait, let me just go back to this slide. You could say like, you know, this is one word in Spanish, this is another word in Spanish. And when, this plus some measurement result is a word in Spanish. And then when these two are at the beginning of a sentence, it's always followed by, when you have this measurement, the result plus one. When it's this plus one, it's followed by this plus one. So, you know, you can just rename what these things are with Spanish words. And then when going down this column, if you have this measurement result being plus one, this measurement result being plus one, this is always minus one. So like in this very constructed example, essentially the meaning of this word completely depends on whether you previously said these two words or these two words. And obviously this is a very constructed example, and it's not really obvious that this should carry over for actual like linguistic contextuality, where the meaning of words depends on previous words in the sentence. But that's sort of the intuition, where the translation, so the measurement result for this word, depends on the previous words in the sentence, sort of.
So now you can, you know, it begs the question of like, which language has the most quantum contextuality in it?
Yeah. I guess what languages have this nice feature, or maybe bad feature for normal machine translation, where the meaning of words heavily depends on previous words in the sentence. So context is very important. And at least numerically, Spanish has enough of this feature to make a difference.
When you describe contextuality in language, I mean, that's a very natural thing. Like the meaning of words depends on previous, but quantum contextuality is just the thing that can be represented, you know, it's like more specific.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
I know. Yeah, I'm definitely doing, you know, linguistic trickery here. And it's more intuition than anything else, because no language is going to have an example where you have two words. So whatever word is represented by Z1, X2, X1, Z2, that give one meaning for Y1, Y2, but then another two words give the exact opposite meaning for Y1, Y2, you know? So, and of course, quantumly, it is very specific to this, but yeah, some of these features are shared in language, and numerically, it seems to have a similar effect. So
it's fascinating. Are there other questions for Eric about the presentation?
Hi, Eric. Could you say a bit more about the fiber bundle that showed up, and exactly what was its importance?
Yeah. So I'm just going to go to this encoder decoder example because it's actually more straightforward here, probably. So if you consider the space of inputs, these XI, this E map maps it to some latent representation in this lambda. And what we show is that when this E is, you know, has this local Lipschitz assumption, and this dimension of lambda is small enough, that this induces this very nice structure on the space of inputs, where you can rewrite everything, like the space of inputs and the space of this latent representation. You can rewrite everything in coordinates, where essentially all this E is doing is projecting out certain coordinates. So in these coordinates, what this input space looks like is this, where E is just a projection map that's projecting out coordinates. So it brings all of the states that only differ in these coordinates to the same point in its latent representation. And because it has this very nice fiber bundle structure, we're able to look at the fiber space, essentially. And then when looking at the fiber space, give this argument that when the dimension of this fiber is large enough, there exist states that have contextual stabilizers. And then, yeah, so that's why the fiber bundle is important, is because we can then look at the fiber space and be able to reason about it in a geometric way.
Okay, interesting. So is there any, maybe you've heard that there's just a Bramsci theory like the sheaf theory of contextuality? Like, can this fit into that framework?
I don't know.
So maybe it's more of a comment or anything, but I wonder.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to look into. Thanks.
Okay, yeah, great. Thank you.
Another work that comes to mind as being possibly related is this paper by Stephen Bartlett and others, where they show that you require n squared bits to classically simulate the stabilizer formalism in some setting where you can make measurement, like you know you have some temporal ordering there as well. I think
that paper definitely is related. This work, along with this work, I have another work that looks at this effectively for qubits, and there it's a similar story but with Bayesian networks, and it's very related to the Stephen Bartlett paper. But we found a few like issues with that proof that were then fixed in this Bayesian network result. And there you can go and have counting arguments because everything is discrete. And so you can literally just count how many input states must be mapped to the same point in latent space by literally a pigeonhole principle argument. But here you can't really do that because everything is continuous because it's a neural network. So that's why we have to use this geometry stuff.
Oh, I see. I guess I was wondering why everything was continuous. And I guess now it makes sense because you want to train it, right? That's why you want.
Yeah, exactly.
I see. Right. Maybe that's a big difference between this and the Brierly work that I mentioned, because I think that has like a Q-dit rather than, well.
Oh, okay.
And I think, anyways, I'm not sure. But at this point, we are at the end of the time allotted for the presentation and questions. So let's thank Eric again.